Om Shanti, and welcome back. Can everyone hear? Everyone's got some translation. I think I've been coming at this time of year for about 25 years. I've never seen it rain so much. Usually you can count on every day being a sunny day, but this time the rain is welcoming us, but it has its own beauty. Tonight, the idea was just to, in a very relaxed way and homely way, talk a little bit about the founder of the Brahma Kumaris, Brahma Baba, and his journey, and give a little bit of context to what's happening, because over the last 2 or 3 days we've heard a lot of the philosophy, a lot of the ideas, a lot of the knowledge, but I think it's a really lovely story. And obviously I wasn't there when he was alive, so I'm telling you what I have heard as well. But I'd love to be very open with you, just very open as our understanding of the early days of this organization, the origins, and the role of Brahma Baba, who is known as the founder. And just to refresh me, I've just made a few notes of his story. His original name was Dada Lake Raj, and he was born in the province of Sindh. And geographically, Sindh is basically in Pakistan now. And so the origins of the organization were in that part of India, former India, before what they call partition, when India and Pakistan were divided. And Brahma Baba really had quite a simple life. His father was a school teacher. And I think this was really the 1880s, so we're talking about a long time ago, in British India. And Brahma Baba actually became a jeweler, and he worked all over India. And I think developed quite a reputation in that business. And we hear a lot of stories that he was very welcome into the courts of the Maharajas. When Mahatma Gandhi really, when they created India as a country, as far as I know, it was like 700 little kingdoms. And all of them had a Maharaja. And those kingdoms really surrendered a lot of wealth to create the state of India or the country of India. And so Brahma Baba would do business with many people, but also a lot of the kings of India. And once in the early 1980s, I went to Calcutta because Brahma Baba's business was based in Calcutta, which was the sort of the capital of India in British India. Who's been to Calcutta, can I ask? Who's been to Calcutta here? Not many, two. It's an extraordinary city, and it was really the capital at that time. And he had his business in a market. And I went along with a relative. There was a man, one of the senior brothers called Dada Anand Kishore. And he was actually married to Brahma Baba's niece, and he worked in the business with Brahma Baba. And he took me into the market and showed me the shop where Brahma Baba would sit. In those days he was known as Dada Lake Raj, where he would sit. And then we started to talk to some of the other jewelers who were working there. And this was in the 1930s in India. And I got the feeling that they lived a very worldly life. You know, Dada Anand Kishore showed us photos of himself in the latest fashions from London. you know, leaning on his Mercedes-Benz and things like that. And it was extraordinary just to see, in a sense, that they were just leading a worldly life at that. Brahma Baba, even though he had his business, was a great devotee. He had a tremendous passion for spirituality. He would read the Gita on a daily basis. And we're told that he had many gurus. Someone even said once 12 different gurus. So while he was living his life, he was on this incredible search for truth. But also a family man. He was married with 5 children. And in his 50s, there's a tradition in India that a man has 4 phases of his life. In the Vedas, they talk about a true sort of Hindu man would have the childhood phase, then the student phase where you study, this is the second phase. The third phase is really where you have a family, you grow. And the fourth phase they call vanprasth, which is really, sometimes it's called the stage of retirement, but often that was when they would adopt a guru, meditate, and in a way develop themselves spiritually and prepare for death as well. And Brahma Baba was moving into that time. And he was in Benares. And I think, you know, as he was getting older, this pull to know God, this pull to, you know, his own truth was getting stronger and stronger. And he had a vision. And this vision just came out of the blue. And his vision was of this extraordinary upheaval in the world. And the way it was described, it was just like the oceans and the mountains were just moving, a massive sort of cataclysm happening around the world. And it just came out of the blue, was unexpected. And so he was sort of left in shock for a few days. He just couldn't really understand what this vision was about. And he was reflecting deeply. And then a few days later, he had another vision. And this vision was of souls coming from the soul world. Dr. Numala was talking about that today, and Daddy Jenki too. Just these little points of light just coming and sitting in the forehead of like divine human beings, which we often refer to as deities, of a golden era. And once again, this vision came, and this vision gave him so much happiness, and yet he couldn't really put it into a context. What was the meaning of all of this? And so he became very reflective, and even his family wondered what was happening to him, because he became much more withdrawn. And he was thinking about the meaning of these visions and having many different experiences at the same time. And around this time, and this was in Hyderabad, Sindh, which is now in Pakistan, in the 1930s. And just the social context, perhaps, as I said, it was British India, very, very conservative time, the time of Mahatma Gandhi. Mahatma Gandhi was gaining huge popularity, and he would be moving around India giving talks, and sometimes, I remember Daddy Jenki telling us that sometimes literally millions would attend rallies, and Mahatma Gandhi would get them to chant and do these sorts of things. So it was an extraordinary time in India, near the end of British India. But Brahma Baba began to hold satsangs, which really means like a spiritual gathering. And people were very attracted to these satsangs, and some would come along, children, old people, and just even coming in front of Brahma Baba, they would go in trance. They would go into like an altered state. And many of them saw a future world, a divine world, and they saw themselves in that world too as divine beings. And this satsang, as you could imagine, became quite popular. And As this was happening, the teachings of the Brahma Kumaris slowly began to emerge. And I probably, as I say, I wasn't there, and I'm sharing with you my own readings and learnings, but it seemed like a very gradual evolvement. And Brahma Baba felt another power working through him. And yet at first he wasn't really sure what was happening. And he had had this massive change from a businessman, a family man, a devotee, into someone who was now instrumental for these spiritual gatherings. And what we understand is that the soul of the Supreme Soul, whom we call Shiv Baba, you heard Daddy talking about Shiv Baba, began to start using Brahma Baba as an instrument. And the teachings weren't really coming from Brahma Baba, but were coming from the Supreme Soul who was entering Brahma Baba and speaking through him. But this took time, and the teachings took time. And these teachings began by saying that we're actually souls, we're eternal souls, and that we're at the end of a cycle of time. And tomorrow I think you're going to explore the concept of cyclic time. That historically we've been through different phases of consciousness and states in the world, but this period of time he called the end of the Iron Age. But there's a bridge between an old culture based on body consciousness and a new culture. And Brahma Baba became the instrument. Shiv Baba began to say he's come to re-educate us how to become soul conscious once again, which is really the seed of the original culture of humanity in this world. And so slowly, slowly these teachings began to come through. And that he also began to teach that for the soul really to heal deeply, for this complete transformation from body consciousness, which, as we've been hearing, is the seed of sorrow and unhappiness, to my original state of soul consciousness, he began to teach about all aspects of purity. Purity of thinking, purity of speech, purity of action, purity in relationships, that really, for the soul to heal, purity is the mother of peace and happiness. And so a part of that purity is that he began to teach like a pure lifestyle, a celibate lifestyle. And you could imagine wherever you would be in the world at that time, that it was in a little community, it was a very conservative community. And even though everyone was attracted, and many young women started to come, and it created a lot of upheaval in the community. There was a lot of upheaval at that time. And because the tradition, it was different for different people, but sometimes girls were betrothed to their husband at birth. When the daughter was born, families would make arrangements. Sometimes girls were married in puberty. And Brahma Baba, or Shiv Baba through Brahma Baba, was inspiring them, you know, to actually become spiritual leaders and spiritual teachers. And it was really an extraordinary time. A lot of upheaval in the community, and even there were court cases and things happening around the origins of this organization. And because of this, Brahma Baba was actually criticized. He was so popular when he was like a community leader, but he received a lot of criticism. But he really saw it that it was like the end of an era of a culture based on body consciousness. And he was sowing the seeds of a new era, creating soul consciousness. And of course, when change comes, there's always resistance to change. And so even though he was criticized, he would be very loving and very merciful and very compassionate towards those who were criticizing him. And one of the things that came out was really the role of women. Because in that time, perhaps all over the world, but especially I think here, you know, women were very much second-class citizens, and as I said, married at very young age, etc. And right from the beginning, Brahma Baba set up a trust of 12 mothers to manage the organization. And even though he was like the instrumental leader, all the main teachers and administration were really done by the sisters. And I remember once being in New York, and once we met one of the undersecretary generals of the United Nations, who was quite familiar with the Brahma Kumaris. And I was talking to him, and he said that as far as he knew, it's the largest spiritual organization in the world run by women. And Brahma Baba was, in a sense, quite a revolutionary in that sense, because he said the mothers and these daughters would be the instruments to bring change in this world. So in a sense, not so much discriminating against men, but the feminine aspect of the human soul, the spirituality, the purity, the virtue side of life, to bring that back into our culture. And I'm not sure the numbers, but I think there's now many, many thousands of fully dedicated sisters in India and around the world. I think well over 10,000. And this, you know, this time after that upheaval, the community really consolidated for 14 years. And often I see that time that it was like Brahma Baba himself was also learning. As we understand it, Shiv Baba, the Supreme Soul, is like eternally pure. And he came into Brahma Baba and was sharing the essence of the knowledge. And Brahma Baba, the one who had life experience, it was like packaging it for the people in front of him, making it relevant for the people in front of him. And so they were working like together. And for 14 years in Pakistan, they really lived in a community of about 300. And each morning they would wake up early, and that whole system of waking up early in the morning to meditate. And then he would encourage them to remain silent, use the early morning to really go deep. And he created this extraordinary environment of becoming soul conscious, because, and I remember when I started realizing that when you really begin to understand you're a soul, you realize we've actually been so addicted to body consciousness. It's like it's so deep in us, the ego of body consciousness. And so Brahma Baba would encourage them to wake up in the morning, sit in their bed and just think, I, the soul, sit in the forehead. They would meditate. They would get up, I, the soul, walk. I, the soul, take my bath. I, the soul, meet. Just to help them re-establish that permanent consciousness and start to let go the habit of body consciousness, which is so deep in all of us. And so over 14 years, he created that atmosphere. And he would even tell the sisters to do all sorts of jobs, even work on cars and do jobs that men would often do, and the brothers to do jobs that women would often do. So they broke out of this socialization and culturalization that this is what a male does, this is what a female does, because actually we're souls. And Baba taught that the soul can take birth in a male body, it can take birth in a female body, and all of us have had played both of those roles. And during those 14 years, they did deep meditation. And I often feel that powerful meditation established the foundation of this organization, because they would sit for hours and hours in silence. And his training, I think, established really the people like Daddy Jenki. When I first started, there were many daddies. A daddy means like an elder sister. There were, I don't know, 40 or 50 of them. And most of them have gone. There's only a handful left because the organization is now 80 years old. But all of them carried a presence, a spirituality, which really came from that training of Brahma Baba in those 14 years. But near the end of that time, there was partition in India. As you know historically, and some of you will know the history much better than me, that the British moved out, and there was the establishment of Pakistan, and to a certain extent the majority from a Muslim background went to Pakistan, and those from a Hindu background remained in India, even though there's still, I think, nearly 200 million Muslims living in India at this time. But it was a chaotic period of history, and millions of people were killed at that time. And this little community decided to move. And one of the original sisters, Didi Manmohini, who was alive when I first came, and she actually, when Brahma Baba died, and I'll talk about that in a little bit, she took over as the co-administrator with one other sister. She came to India to look for a place to move the whole organization, and they chose Mount Abu. And in those days, Mount Abu was extremely remote. And I first came here in 1975. The road up the mountain was like a dirt road. There was no wall. And when another car came the other way, well, it was challenging to get around each other. It was just a tiny little road. And Mount Abu used to be a place where a lot of the kings, the kings of Rajasthan, had their summer palaces. And they would come up with their elephants. They would bring their elephants. There's still the elephant road, still is there up the mountain. They would come in the summer to bring their families and all their things because it was so hot in Rajasthan. They would come up. And they chose Mount Abu. And the original campus was Pandav Bhavan, where some of you were today and some of you will be tomorrow. But it was really only those original buildings when you walk in the front. It was very simple. And even when I came, it was such a simple organization. When I came, there was only 35 residents of Mount Abu, but they had one car. You could imagine. And when you traveled around India, no one had heard of the Brahma Kumaris. And yet the spiritual power was incredible. I remember when I came, the atmosphere of meditation, the atmosphere of spirituality was just a palpable atmosphere. And it certainly had a huge influence on me when I came. And so they moved here in the early 1950s. And at the same time, they began to establish centers around India. And I remember that Daddy Janki telling us, she went to different places and she started in Pune, just to give you an idea of how simple the organization was in those days. Her center where she lived, she was on her own. She had one room. In that room she slept, she took her bath, she cooked and she taught, all in one room. And you could imagine, you know, such a simple life. And I remember Sister Jenty, who you're going to meet, she's just arriving tonight or tomorrow, I'm not exactly sure. Many of you do know her. She told me a few years ago, she thought the reason that Daddy has reached 100 years old is in those days, they couldn't even really afford much to take public transport, buses and things. So she walked everywhere. She would walk many kilometers a day, and we all know that walking, what it does for your health. But at this time too, Brahma Baba was really like, we don't see Brahma Baba as a guru. We've never seen him as a guru. Even though his photo is here, we see him as an example, but when we meditate, and Brahma Baba would always point to Shiv Baba, the teachings are from the Supreme Soul, and when we meditate, we try to go beyond and connect with that point form, the form of God. And Brahma Baba used to say that the human soul can exist on four different levels of consciousness. The first is really like a very material consciousness where, you know, you just observe things happening. You go to the theatre, you go to a football match, you just observe life. And that's the consciousness most of us live on, a sort of a gross consciousness in one way. The second level of consciousness is creative, an artist, a musician, a scientist, where you're not focusing on the material world, but you're creating ideas or music or whatever in your mind. The third he called subtle consciousness, when a spiritual person, a religious person, maybe visualizes Christ or visualizes a prophet soul or a saint or whoever it may be. And when you do, you get feelings, you get certain spiritual feelings, but you're still remembering a human form. And Brahma Baba would say that still you remain body conscious, even when you have spiritual feelings, because you're remembering a form of a saint or a prophet or a guru, whoever, you're still in a body conscious form. So he inspired to go beyond all human form to remember God in the eternal form of light, which is the image that God is remembered in most religions. And so thereby I become soul conscious. And Brahma Baba himself practiced and practiced and practiced to become soul conscious, because he used to say that you can believe in God, but you can only have a connection when you're on the same wavelength. If God is eternally a soul, to really connect, communicate, have the link that really brings all the power back in the soul, you've got to go up to the same wavelength and become soul conscious. And so Brahma Baba himself had this deep practice, and people used to feel that as he ate, as he spoke, as he moved, he had this gentle attention to keep his intellect with God. And that's why really he didn't even really like the word meditation much, or yoga, because it sounded too formal. He called it remembrance, that really for the human spirit to take back the power that is lost through time, we remember God. And he became an example and would inspire many to do that. And as I was saying, they began service in the early 1950s. And I think that even when they went out into India, you could imagine that some of these ideas were new, and the community, some places accepted it, some places they were very challenging, some of these ideas. And I think it was very challenging that women were teaching, because there wasn't really that tradition within at least the world, probably, let alone this culture. But slowly, slowly, the Brahma Kumaris have become quite accepted. And I think now operate in, I'm not exactly sure how many, officially we often say about 110 or 20 countries, but there's more countries as well. And personally, you know, my own journey, I've been involved with 41 years, and I know we all have a journey, we all have an experience, but I think one of the things I've really enjoyed about the BKs is that, as we're known, often people call us the BKs. I was telling someone today that there is a guy who came here from Sydney, and he really loved the Brahma Kumaris, and he wrote to a friend in London and said, you should visit the BKs, they're good people. And his friend wrote back to him, I've looked up the phone book and there's 45 branches of the Burger Kings in London. So we didn't realize there's another BK as well. But people of all religious backgrounds. And you know, a few years ago, the main center in Sydney, which is where I'm based, we had seven sisters living in the center. Three of them were from a Christian background, one Hindu, one Buddhist, one Muslim, and one Jewish. And all meditating together, all on the spiritual journey together. And I think it's really lovely thing, because the whole Shiv Baba through Brahma Baba is the fundamental understanding is that we're souls. And when we understand we're souls, experience we're souls, that then that really sees us all as a family of humanity. And all the differences are really based on the superficial physical differences, bodily differences. And Brahma Baba was a really inspiring personality, and you hear so many stories of an extraordinary capacity to love. Even when people didn't show that to him, it was like he felt so much love from God that he just became an instrument of love. And there's one of the people in Bombay, I remember him telling us, who he was a professor of philosophy, and he came to meet Brahma Baba. And he's still involved with this organization. And he argued and argued and argued with him about a lot of these concepts, because they're a little bit different, or sometimes quite different from some traditional ideas. And yet he said when he left, Brahma Baba would always meet and also take leave through what we call drishti, which is like the soul giving a vision of love and belonging through the eyes. And he said, even though they'd talked and argued, his love through the eyes was so great, he knew that this was someone completely different. And Brahma Baba, in 1969, and I'm moving a little bit fast at the moment because I'm watching the clock as well, but he left the body, as we say, on January the 18th, 1969. And quite frankly, it wasn't expected. Even though he was in his late 80s, mid to late 80s, they always thought that he would be with them. And one night he took evening class in Pandav Bhavan in the history hall. And he took leave from all the children. He would always say namaste and bow. And he walked out into his room. He lay down. And Dadi Prakashmani, one of the original sisters, her name means like the jewel of light, she followed him. He lay on his bed and he took her hand, and slowly, slowly, it's almost like the energy of the soul left the body, and she could almost feel it in his hand, and the soul flew from the body. And people really, for 3 days, they really didn't know what was happening. And many came from different parts of India, because by then the organization had grown but still wasn't huge. And after 3 days, Dadi Gulzar, who you haven't met as yet, but she's one of the original sisters who's still alive, she was a trance messenger. She began with the organization when she was 9 years old. And she had this gift of going into trance. Like we see, the Supreme Soul pulls the soul into trance and would give messages to them in trance. She went in trance, and the souls of Shiv Baba and Brahma Baba came through her and began to speak. And this began a new part of this organization that we call those two souls together. I hope this isn't too much at the moment. We call them Bap, the father, and Dada, like the senior brother. Bap, Shiv Baba, and Brahma Baba, they began to come and teach. And we call it like the subtle part, the angelic part. And it's like Brahma Baba, what we understand was through his effort, through his meditation, he settled his karmic story. He freed himself and he flew and became like an angel and still serves like an angel and still comes and meets what he calls the children through the instrument of Dadi Gulzar. And this began in 1969 and really has gone on for 48 years since then, and the teachings have continued. And I don't know how it sounds to all of you, but when I first came, I was 22 years old, and I'd been traveling and searching, as I mentioned, I think, the other night. And like many of us, you know, life is that journey. And only I had been practicing in London for a few months, and I came. And the first day I came, Baba, as we say, came through the medium of Daddy Gulzar. And when Baba would come, and he always meets everyone through the eyes, maybe for 5 or 10 minutes, takes the fragrance of the gathering and then teaches, takes up all different subjects. And then afterwards he would meet personally, and it was only a small gathering, and I sat right in front. And it was an amazing feeling, because it was like Baba, through the instrument of Daddy Gulzar, Baba was like, sits in the forehead and uses the mouth. Daddy Gulzar isn't aware at that time. She's not aware of what is happening. And Baba looked deep into my soul, if I can say. And the feeling was, I often had the feeling, it was like a laser sort of went so deep into the soul and scanned the memory track of the soul. You know, we carry our whole story in our subconscious. But he fell on a part of me, which I can only say was like the original me, the elevated me. And I had this experience that it was almost like he massaged that to the surface, introduced me to who I really was. And something shifted in me at that time. It was almost like, I think often the great challenge in life is living in your self-respect in all scenes of life with all personalities. And something shifted in the way I felt about myself. It was almost like a realization of who I really was. And I often feel that that meeting changed me. And I met Baba through the medium many, many, many times, as many others have here. And it's a really unique story. And I think the community is a really unique and wonderful community. And often we call ourselves like the Brahman family, from so many different backgrounds, from so many different cultures, etc., and yet come together on the basis of soul consciousness as the foundation of the future world. And I think at the beginning I mentioned that I wanted to keep a little bit of time for questions, but I've been going on and on and on, so excuse me. But if you're not feeling tired, and if you want to go to bed, please feel free. You have every permission. But if you would like to ask something, don't hesitate. As I said, I just wanted to tell you in essence the story of the journey of this organization to this point of time. So if anyone would like to ask something, or would you prefer I wind up? You can tell me, I don't mind. Any questions? Who's ready for sleep? There's a question. I can repeat it if you like. So she's just asking how many of the daddies are still alive. Just a handful. Because the organization is 80 years old. You heard Daddy Jenki say, I've been a Brahma Kumari for 80 years. Now she's nearly 101. Daddy Gulzar is nearly 90. Daddy Ratan Mohini is 90. So, but what I've noticed is still, the teacher is Baba and is still coming. But there's generations now. There's the generation, that's the original generation, the daddies, and they've brought up more and more generations. And around India now, there's as I'm not sure how many fully surrendered sisters there are, but probably more than 10,000 of them. So they've all passed their wisdom, their experience. And Brahma Baba created a whole system of management in the centers, all based on spiritual values. And the daddies have taught that to the next generation. That generation has taught that. So that sort of culture continues. And one of the things I think in the Brahma Kumaris is to love everybody, appreciate everybody, but not be dependent on anyone at all, even Brahma Baba. That ultimately, really, the connection is with God, not through any human being. So there's this deep love, deep appreciation of an example, a spiritual inspiration, but not treating any human being as a guru. And in fact, Brahma Baba would say, the age of gurus is now finishing, where we sort of focus on a human being, that when each of us has our own connection with God, we're all empowered in that way. And so I think the centers all over India, if you go, they're huge. There's like 10,000 centers around India. And in many of the centers, there's 20, 30 sisters. There's a center close to here called Mesana, which is like a lot of, it's connected with a lot of villages. And there's a sister called Sala who runs it. She's been doing it for a long time. And once I went there, and she has about 15 or 20 sisters living with her, and they serve 500 villages around that town. 500. The sisters go out every day and teach. They go all over the place. It's extraordinary, actually, the outreach all over the country, right through Nepal, right through remote regions in Nagaland, all over the country, the Brahma Kumaris are there. And they all follow a similar system that the daddies have taught them. So I think the culture is very alive and well. Yes, there's a few questions. I don't know, did we get a microphone? I'm sorry, I can't hear. Yes. How does the organization, how's it managed? You know, once I remember Daddy Prakashmini, who was the head for 40-something years. She died in 2007. When Brahma Baba left his body in 1969, he appointed two sisters, Daddy Prakashmini, which means the jewel of light, and Didi Manmohini, the one who attracts through her mind. And once Daddy Prakashmini was in New York and she met, I think it was the CEO of IBM. And he, you know, the organization grew enormously in her time. There's now a million people with, you know, as I said, 10,000 centers just in India, let alone the world. And she didn't have a mobile phone or a computer. And I think he couldn't believe that she ran an organization without a mobile phone or a computer. And I would say, the management is based on love and respect. And once someone said, the culture is a respectocracy, to give respect, which is the nature of soul consciousness, keeps everyone close and keeps a sense of belonging. No matter how different people are different. And so that's kept, it's a family feeling. So there's a family feeling, but that family also, shall we say, teaches people, anyone who wants to learn, so does service as well. But financially, it has always been by donation, and we never charge fees anywhere. So if people take benefit, they want to help. And yet, like in Australia, where I'm mostly, we have three retreat centers. And every weekend people come and learn at the retreat centers. And some people don't have money, so they're still welcome. But some people do, and it all sort of balances out, really. But we have donation boxes in all the centres, and if they want to help to support the running of the centres, even these centres here too, they have program after program. People come and they donate into the boxes. But generally, you see now the facilities are huge, but up until the last maybe 10 or 20 years, it was very small. And it's the generosity of people who have taken benefit that have enabled the organization to grow until this day. And someone said to me recently, I don't know whether it's true, that the Brahma Kumaris is one of the few organizations in the world that doesn't charge for their services, spiritual groups. I don't know whether that's true, but it's a principle that Daddy Jenki and the daddies keep strongly to. They like to keep these sort of original principles created by Brahma Baba, because they sort of hold the purity. And as you could imagine, as organizations grow, it's easy for them to get different influences. But they're more interested that they grow carrying the original values and principles than, you know, really just growth for growth's sake, if I can say.
Thanks.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure. There's another gentleman.
My question has been asked. I was mostly interested in this very center here. How did it come about? Was it also donations which came before the center, or the donations came after the center? Thank you.
No, I can remember when this was farming land, actually. And I can remember when Daddy Prakashmani, I think it was in about 20 years ago, they were outgrowing the original campus in Pandav Bhavan, and they wanted to have a learning center, like a spiritual center. This is called Gyan Sarova, which means like the lake of knowledge in a way. And so we came here, and I remember they dug a big hole, and it's auspicious in India to crack a coconut to inaugurate it. We had hundreds of coconuts, and all of us stood around smashing coconuts to sort of... But I think... And what Daddy Prakashmani... She encouraged anyone who would love to contribute, even in just a rupee or something like that, to create their fortune so that this such a place could be created. And when you go down below to see what we call Shantivan, which is like the forest of peace, it means it's a huge complex. I think they sleep over 20,000 people down there. There's a hall for 25,000-30,000 people. It's extraordinary. And the same thing, it's all on the goodwill of people and of students. One, to build it, and secondly, to sustain it and sustain the activities for people. And they run all sorts of programs for all different types, groups of people who come. And from all corners of the world too. Mainly from this time, from October through till the end of March, people come from different parts of the world. And even we have another retreat in November called Inner Peace, Inner Power. And that has been going 6 or 7 years, and people from all over the world come, but mainly from the Middle East and Asia. But mainly people come from the Middle East for that retreat. Yes.
You mentioned that Brahma Baba was married and had 5 kids. Where are they now?
Well, one of them still is alive in Bombay, and his daughter was a Brahma Kumari who ran the Eastern Zone, which was Calcutta, that side. Her name was Dadi Nirmala Shanta. She was absolutely beautiful. It's hard to describe just how lovely that personality was. She was extraordinary. She died at 98, just a few years ago. But Brahma Baba died in his 80s and 69, and now there's only one child left. All his children joined the organization, and Daddy Nirmalashanta stayed. One of them died, I think, and a few of them moved on into other lives as well. But he had five children, but only one surviving now. But on the 18th of January each year, which is the day of Brahma Baba's passing, as we say, when he left the body, his son, Narayan, comes to Mount Abu each 18th of January. He's about 90 now. He's about 90 years old, yes. There was someone who had their hand up here, but... Okay. So thanks so much, everyone. And if you want, if we meet Daddy Janki again, I'm sure if you get her telling stories about Brahma Baba, she will go on and on and on and on and on. She's got hundreds of them. So let's just have a few minutes of meditation, and let's have a wonderful sleep, and we'll see everyone in here tomorrow morning. So thanks, everyone. Good night.